Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture titled The Great Satan, Images of Evil in Islamic Tradition. This is the last in a series of lectures looking at the topic of evil, presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Our main speaker tonight will be Eric Ormsby, director of the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University. We'll also hear comments from William Graham, professor of divinity and dean of the Harvard Divinity School. Moderating tonight's discussion is Ray Hart, professor of religion and dean ad interim of the School of Theology at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by associate professor of religion and Institute for Philosophy and Religion director, David Eckel.
I'm delighted that you're all here to help us put the finishing touches on our year's series on evil. As you know, in the Institute for Philosophy and Religion this year, we've been studying the concept of evil from a number of different angles. And I've often said when I make introductory remarks to events like this that one of the reasons we think this is so important is that the concept of evil, especially in the clash of civilizations in the Middle East, has been a political problem for us as well as an intellectual problem. And lurking in the background has, of course, been the Muslim tradition, the tradition of Islam that has provided us with so many of the most troubling and challenging views of evil that are present in the cultural and political world that all of us experience daily when we open the newspapers. So we're really delighted tonight to finish our series with a lecture by Professor Eric Ormsby from McGill University on the images of Satan in the Muslim tradition. I'm very happy that he's agreed to join us and that Professor William Graham, Dean of Harvard Divinity School, has agreed to serve as commentator. And our other respected luminary here at Boston University, Professor Ray Hart, Dean ad interim of the School of Theology, has agreed to serve as moderator for the evening. So it is an evening full of, I would say, great star power. How about that? Yes, amongst all three of you. Anyway, Ray, let me turn things over to you, and why don't you get us going?
It's my pleasant assignment to introduce Professor Eric Ormsby. One is awed by his accomplishments, clearly a multi-talented, multitasker. I'll give you just some clues. His undergraduate education was at the University of Pennsylvania, majoring in Oriental Studies. His graduate work in library science was at Rutgers, and his master's in Near Eastern Studies together with his PhD at Princeton. He has studied as well at the Sorbonne and at the University of Tübingen in Germany. I mentioned multi-careered. He has been director of libraries, curator of libraries at McGill, at Catholic University of America, and at Princeton, in addition to his work as a scholar and teacher. His publications, as you would expect, are extraordinarily numerous and varied. He is a translator of classical Islamic texts. He is a contributor to many dictionaries and encyclopedias, the Cambridge History of Arabic Literature, the HarperCollins Dictionary of Religion, the Dictionary of the Middle Ages, and so on. Of his many books, I will cite only the one most directly pertinent to the topic of the day, namely his 1984 book published by Princeton Press, Theodicy in Islamic Thought, The Dispute Over Al-Ghazali's Best of All Possible Worlds. So it is with great pleasure that we welcome so distinguished an Islamic scholar, scholar of Islam, as our speaker this evening on the topic of this year. We are similarly fortunate to have a commensurately distinguished scholar of Islam as respondent and commentator. William Graham is the Murray Albertson Professor of Middle Eastern Studies in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard, as he is the John Lord O'Brien Professor of Divinity and presently Dean of Harvard Divinity School. He was a summa cum laude graduate of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and his graduate work at both the master's and doctoral levels were at Harvard, where he has held almost every conceivable responsibility as a master and tutor of houses, as director of the Center of Middle Eastern Studies, as chair of the Committee on the Study of Religion, as a teacher in the core curriculum in the College of Arts and Sciences, and on and on. He, too, is a contributor to encyclopedias and dictionaries, having served as associate editor of the Encyclopedia of the Quran. He's been on many editorial boards, has held a Guggenheim Fellowship, von Humboldt Research Fellowship, and among his many books, I may mention his book that won the American Council of Learned Societies award for the best first book in the history of religions, Divine Word and Prophetic Word. So, we could not do better in bringing these two speakers and commentators on evil in Islam, more especially the faces of Satan in Islam. Professor Hornsby.
Thank you very much, Professor Hart. We don't usually think of Satan as a family man, but in at least one legend from the Islamic tradition, we find him saddled with the chief problem of a single parent, childcare. Of Mrs. Satan, we know nothing. Satan had a young son, a mere toddler, whose name was Khanas, and the name is Quranic and means to draw back or slink. The devil's a busy fellow and always in need of babysitters. One morning he comes to Adam and Eve's home when Adam is out. "Would you please watch my little boy for a few hours?" he asks. The kind-hearted mother of mankind agrees. Adam comes home to find the devil's child sitting in his own house, and he's furious. He seizes Khanas, chops him into little pieces, and scatters them over a field. When Satan returns, he calls out to his child, and all the chopped-up pieces instantly reassemble. A few days later, Satan again asks Eve to babysit, and despite her fear of Adam's disapproval, she agrees. Adam comes home, falls into a rage, then grabs Khanas and burns him to ashes, which he sprinkles to the winds. Satan shows up, calls his son by name. The ashes recompose themselves into the child. A third time, Satan appears and again asks Eve to mind the child. Against her better judgment, Eve minds him yet again. When Adam discovers the child a third time in his home, he's beside himself. He butchers Khanas, roasts him in the oven, and then he and Eve eat him for supper. Satan comes back. He calls his child. Khanas answers him from inside the bodies of Adam and Eve. And Satan exclaims, "It worked. That's just what I wanted." And from that day to this, man has the devil in his flesh. This is a preacher's tale, but the notion of an urge to wickedness in the very fibers of our flesh, a prompting inseparable from our deepest selves, like the Yetzer Hara of the Jewish tradition, finds warrant in the Quran. In a famous verse from the Surah of Joseph, Yusuf, we read, quotes, "Man's very soul incites him to evil." Inna nafsa la'amaratun bisu'i. And yet part of the force of the tale is that this is an ingested evil, a propensity to wickedness that has come into mankind from outside. Now, the title of my talk was The Two Faces of Islam, but since I began writing it, I've discovered there are at least three, so we may have to modify this. He has at least three faces in the Islamic tradition. Certain of these, Satan as a source of defilement and Satan as a tempter, will be familiar to you. A third face, that of Satan, as not only our most intimate enemy, but our secret ally, may be less so. In describing this final face of our ancient adversary, I'll propose that this ultimate visage takes its shape concurrent with a renewed emphasis by Muslim mystics on the love of God. I won't have enough time to detail this proposition for you, and so I offer it here more as a working hypothesis. If I use broad strokes to depict this triply visaged devil for you, somewhat in the manner of a police artist constructing a composite portrait of a perpetrator, I nevertheless hope to convey something of the paradox and subtlety of Satan in the Islamic tradition. Certainly, there would seem to be nothing either paradoxical or particularly subtle about the great Satan, the Shaitani Buzurg, of furious mobs in Tehran, or more recently in Beirut, who howled death to America as a rallying cry. For them, we Americans collectively are incarnations of the satanic. This, of course, is the devil as irremediably other, as an entity intrinsically repugnant and malignant, a source of evil that is absolutely outside of ourselves, a wickedness that stands in violent opposition to the values and beliefs of the members of the community, and that is hated and feared in equal measure. Hated because it appears as the antithesis of belief, feared because it has the malign power of a contagion. The accursed Satan is a primitive but potent embodiment of evil. He forms part of that eerie horde of supernatural beings Islam inherited from its Arabian prehistory. Not only various voracious female deities, such as Izzat and Lat, but the mysterious beings known as the jinn and assorted forms of ghoul. The jinn represent a separate category of being. They are creatures of pure fire and often mentioned in the Quran. In Surah 55, for example, we read that God, and I quote, created mankind out of dried clay like pottery, the jinn out of smokeless fire. In Surah 72, also entitled the jinn, we learn that these beings eavesdropped on recitations of the Quran and were converted, even though, as it is written, and I quote, men have sought refuge with the jinn in the past, but they only misguided them further, end quote. And yet the jinn are not necessarily evil. Quote from another verse, some of us, the jinn say, are righteous and others less so. We follow different paths. The jinn are tricky. Sometimes they work good, at others they dazzle, deceive, and mislead. The common word for crazy in Arabic, majnoon, reflects their power over humans. To be insane is to be possessed by a jinn. And in several passages of the Quran, it is explicitly denied that Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, is insane, that is, jinn-possessed. Of other supernatural beings dwelling in the desert, the ghoul is probably the most horrific. Our English word comes from Arabic, ghoul. Ghouls are predatory, and deception is their hallmark. Taking the appearance of beautiful women, they loiter by the roadside to entice unwary men. If a man approaches them, they reveal their true shapes, leap upon his back, and rape him. Men raped by ghouls often conceive and bring forth little ghouls. The 9th century writer Al-Jahiz, in his Book of Animals, cites an anonymous verse to show that ghouls even trick men occasionally into marrying them. As he says, and I quote, in my youth, I married a ghoul who resembled a gazelle. And the 8th century poet Al-Farazdaq can describe a terrifying landscape as being like the vulva of a ghoul. The jinn, ghouls, and other monsters have in common the practice of deceit. Satan is deceitful too, but his brand of falsehood is not merely a matter of outward appearance. Satan's mendacity is subtler, and it is also more dangerous, because his wiles collude with our own innermost propensities. In the Quran, and especially in the earlier portions, Satan appears as a whispering insinuator. Mischievous or malicious whispering, conveyed in Arabic by the wonderful word waswas, stands in stark contrast to the full-throated clarion utterances of God and his prophet. Surah 114, the final chapter of the Quran, conveys this with supreme succinctness, and I quote, I seek refuge with the Lord of people, the master of people, the God of people, against the evil of the slinking whisperer who whispers into the hearts of people, whether they be jinn or people. This face of Satan is ringed in the early surahs of the Quran with an aura of darkness, of spells and sly whispers, with the witches who blow on knots, with all that is uncanny, menacing, spooky, and sinister. But it isn't the final face of Satan, as he appears in the Holy Text. That face is more complex and even somewhat contradictory. And the enigma of that compound visage engendered a rich tradition over the centuries in Islam, especially among those mystics known as Sufis. The locus classicus appears in the second and longest surah of the Quran, the Cow, in verses 30 to 37. Here we encounter Satan under both his principal names, Shaitan and Iblis. Shaitan, of course, is from the Semitic root in Hebrew, Hasatan, the adversary or opponent, as he appears, for example, in the book of Job. By contrast, Iblis is an Arabicized version of the Greek word diabolos, or devil. In the Quranic passage, God informs his angels that he intends to create a vice regent on earth, a khalifa. The angels object. Mankind, they say, will wreak havoc and cause bloodshed. God simply replies, I know things you do not. He then proceeds to teach Adam the names of all things. He brings Adam to the angelic assembly and challenges the angels to tell him the names of all things. When they cannot, God asks Adam to say the names. He does so, and God commands the angels, bow down before Adam. Here our devil makes his appearance. All the angels bowed, and here I'm quoting from the Quran, except for Iblis, who refused and was arrogant. He was one of the kafirs. From this refusal springs Satan's enmity with all mankind. In the Quran, it is in fact Satan who connives to have Adam and Eve expelled from the garden. Now, in the Arabic text of the passage, Iblis, quotes, refused and was arrogant. Aba wastakbara, and so is termed one of the unbelievers, min al-kafirin. To be arrogant means to consider or proclaim oneself great, but this is a prerogative reserved for God alone. Arrogance is the sin of Pharaoh, who exclaimed, I am your Lord Most High. When the devil refuses to bow down, the name Iblis is used. When he has Adam and Eve banished from paradise, the name Shaitan is used. Now, it seems odd to call Satan a kafir, usually translated as unbeliever. But the Arabic word so translated possesses a span of meanings quite different from our equivalents. Kufr, the noun, has connotations of hiding something and hence of ingratitude. But more generally, a kafir may be defined as someone who stands excluded from the Islamic community of belief. And by belief, I don't mean simply adherence to a creed, but acting in belief. Where then does Satan's kufr, his unbelief, lie? Not merely in outright disobedience to God, but in his repudiation of his creation in human form. It is in his rejection of man that his disbelief resides. This small distinction will have large consequences, for just as Shaitan Iblis will be transformed by radical mystics into a figure to emulate, so too, even the term kufr, one of the most abhorrent in the creedal lexicon, will become for some the most extreme expression of its opposite, pure, untrammeled belief. The notion of Satan in Islam as a sly and whispering seducer of mankind has force because of the psychic construction of the human agent. Satan himself, in Islam as in Judaism, is circumscribed severely in his power. The conception of an entity somehow in a position to challenge God was unthinkable for Muslims from the earliest period, and the figure of Satan is never invoked to explain, for instance, the persistence of evil or the fall of man. Rather, Satan is a kind of unofficial servant, a Sabbath goy, if you like, called in for shady or difficult cases, such as putting Job to the test. What power the Islamic Satan possesses derives from the weakness of human will. This is because human beings are endowed with a kind of life force, a soul, called nafs. There's no single English word that conveys the range of connotations of nafs. We see it rendered as soul or carnal soul, sometimes to a self. Sometimes it seems to represent what a Freudian might call the id. In essence, it is that blind, craving, voracious component of the person that both gives us vitality and energy, but also can lead to a slavish dependence on the senses or the appetites. This greedy self offers Satan a breach of our defenses. Even so, the self is not intrinsically evil. Rather, it is a kind of retarding element that holds a person back and causes him or her to cling to habit. The nafs is our deep sensual layer, whereas the heart or mind, the Arabic word qalb denotes both, represents our deep spiritual layer. A heart, too, may be good or bad. Just as the nafs prompts the actions of the limbs and organs, the heart undergoes its own inner actions for good or for evil. The heart is the seat of faith, but it may become the seat of doubt or hypocrisy as well. Given our inner and outer natures, we are vulnerable to the whisperings of Satan, who knows our weakness. How do we combat this? Al-Muhasibi developed a method which had a wide influence on pious practice, and which, almost incidentally, allowed for the development of a mystical psychology in Islam. The name Muhasibi derives from the verbal noun in Arabic, muhasaba, which denotes an accounting or reckoning. In the case of al-Muhasibi himself, his cultivation of a form of moral accounting led to the moniker he was to bear forever after. This moral accounting is similar to what we might call an examination of conscience. For the 8th century Sufi, it betokens standing in judgment upon oneself, just as God will do at the last judgment. And al-Muhasibi elaborates what this entails in a passage from his autobiography, which I will read. The Sufi, he says, comes to know his sins by recalling the hours of the day just past. Only thus can he know them. He recalls how he comported himself in these past hours of his life, how he handled the duties that he neglected or the trespasses that he committed. He reviews the days of his life that have passed, how he behaved during these days, what he did and what he did not do, and what his inner disposition was when he so acted. He recalls how he behaved when he was angry or when things went well for him, how he loved and how he hated, acquired and expended and retained, how he remitted what he owed, and how he accepted what others owed to him, whether honestly or not. He recalls how he spoke, looked, and listened, how he placed his feet when he walked, and how he took hold of things with his hand. He calls to mind the annoyances he suffered unjustly when people brought claims against him with regard to their property or their honor, as well as the duties he has to his relatives and to others to whom he is obligated. He practices recollection as one does who is determined to be pure before he stands before the face of God. Here he introduces an analogy, comparing such a man to one who finds a basket full of bottles by the road, all of which are sealed with stoppers. Most people pass by without noticing, but he stops and takes out the stoppers. Out of certain bottles, pleasant odors arise, such as musk or amber or saffron or jasmine. Out of others, however, foul stenches climb, naphtha, tar, and pitch. In this way, he learns his own good and bad qualities. Now, we shouldn't infer from this that al-Muhasibi regards man as the sole source of evil. The devil still plays his role. In fact, Satan has a supreme advantage over humans. Satan cannot see the future, but he has a long past, and he has a good memory. Our adversary knows the human heart and soul from time immemorial. He plays the human soul as a practiced musician manipulates a lute. Our defenses, by contrast, are meager. All our stratagems avail us little. One way alone promises escape from his lures, that is, complete absorption in God. Even our virtues, after all, nourish our vanity. It is the adept in particular, those who think they have routed Satan, who are most in danger. We must examine the self in order not only to cleanse and scour it, but to dispense with it entirely. The scrupulosity that led al-Muhasibi and others to anatomize the human self produced a subtle mystical psychology. Nor was this watchfulness concerned only with tracking down and exterminating evil impulses. These, after all, originated in the human self. They were obstructions. They bore witness to our frailty. More interesting by far were other, profounder workings of the psyche, and as Sufism developed in sophistication and depth, these signs became apparent as well. If the human being is a kind of hypostasis of heart and mind, heart and soul, mind and self, in incessant tension, as one early ascetic put it, if man is a being of sundered extremes, in another formulation, then he is also a creature fashioned by the hand of God, and God's wonders, the marvels of his artistry, are evident as well in man. Man is the most amazing of beings, writes a later mystic, and yet he does not seize himself with awe. Know yourself if you wish to know your Lord, says another. Needless to say, we're far here from the words of the theologian, the worlds of the theologian and the philosopher. For the theologians, those dialecticians or mutakallimun in Arabic, good and evil are ethical values defined as husn for goodness or qubh for badness. And the words also denote what is pleasing or beautiful and what is repellent or ugly. Later, for mainstream theologians of the Asharite school, which came to prevail in Islam, evil lost all meaning as an independent ethical quality, for it is God himself who creates both good and evil. Whatever happens must be good, because it would not have happened if God had not willed it. God's actions define value, not vice versa. Now, for the philosophers, or falasifa, the issue becomes even more abstract. Following Plato, Aristotle, and Plotinus, the ancient masters whose thought they continued and elaborated, evil is sheer lack of good. Goodness exists in the fullness of being, evil in its diminishment. The drastic exercise in self-knowledge, which I've sketched here, would lead eventually to a terrific deepening of the relationship between God and his human creatures in the Islamic mystical tradition. From the outset, even in the early highly ascetic period of Sufism, when the fear of God, assiduously cultivated, led to painstaking concentration on the actions of the heart and the body, there were glimmerings of an awareness of the possibility, if not the full reality, of a love of God. Belief in the love of God, so prominent in the Christian tradition, is conspicuous by its absence in the major canonical works of Islamic theology and ritual practice. No dogmatic theologian discusses it. In fact, it is precluded both logically and theologically by the early theological treatises. Logically, because a relationship can exist only between members of the same genus and species, and God transcends both. Theologically, because even if the Quran does affirm that he, God, loves them and they love him, love is not a divine attribute, as power, knowledge, will, and the others are. Divine love is present throughout the Quran, to be sure, but it takes the form of supreme compassion, of mercifulness, rather than that love which depends upon some affinity and reciprocity between persons. Certain early Sufis, such as the famous woman mystic Rabia al-Adawiyya, who died around 801, and especially Abul Hasan al-Nuri, who died a century later in 907, did teach a doctrine of God's love. An-Nuri, however, suffered for his views. He and some 75 other proponents of divine love were put on trial in Baghdad at the instigation of one Ghulam Khalil, a strict, old-fashioned ascetic mystic, along with the chief qadi, or judge, of Baghdad. Because An-Nuri had used the Arabic word ishq, a term that signifies intense, usually erotic love, to describe the feelings he had for God, he was charged with heresy. An-Nuri was acquitted in the end, but the scandal remained to be carried to its furthest consequences, by the slightly later mystic Hussein ibn Mansur al-Hallaj, who was executed quite horribly in 922. The charges against him were various, but the most damaging charge held that he had exclaimed, "I am the truth," that is, "I am God," Ana al-Haq, in a Baghdad mosque. Now, these crucial early figures and the tendencies and schools they engendered have been studied intensively for some time now by such great scholars as Louis Massignon, Helmut Ritter, and others. But I don't merely want to recapitulate their findings here. My hypothesis, which I will present to you here in a succinct form, builds on a somewhat different foundation than theirs. It's this. The doctrine of the love of God coincides with the transformation of Satan in the Islamic mystical tradition in a way that suggests that the two are linked. Historically, the initial impetus for a new and decisive emphasis on God's love comes from a somewhat unlikely source. The jurist, theologian, and philosopher, and Sufi author Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, who died in 1111, and who composed in Arabic the most thorough and systematic treatise on divine love. The transformation of Satan begins to take shape only slightly later in the work of al-Ghazali's younger brother Ahmad al-Ghazali, who died in 1126, and who wrote mostly in Persian, the mother tongue of both brothers. The two brothers couldn't have been more different. Abu Hamid, the elder and the more famous even today, was a medieval polymath of dazzling virtuosity whose massive and most famous work, The Revival of the Sciences of Religion, is still read and revered by Muslims. Younger brother Ahmad, though equally learned, was utterly dissimilar. He was a street preacher, a homilist, a master of the telling anecdote. It is to him that we owe the story of Satan and his son, which I recounted at the outset. Moreover, because he wrote almost exclusively in Persian and was a master stylist in that language, he created a lexicon of love and a set of tropes that were to dominate Persian poetry for centuries to come. It is Ahmed who elaborates a new transformative theology of Satan. This is not entirely his own. He owes a debt to earlier masters and especially to Al-Hallaj. But his older brother, by establishing the plausibility of a relationship of love between God and man, and by doing so cogently, methodically, and I would say irrefutably, an endeavor that would not have been possible had the elder al-Ghazali not made the Avicennian world system so intensely his own, set the stage for the reappearance of Satan in transfigured guise. For Satan is, in one sense, the ultimate lover of God. He loves God, even though God curses him and casts him out. Indeed, he loves God because God does banish him. To be singled out by God in such a way is, perversely, to assume the badge, or perhaps the scar would be the better word, of a radical honor. To love God against God is to love God for his own soul's sake. No reward for such love may be expected. And with the removal of reward, love is based purely on itself. Satan's refusal to bow down before God's creation in human form, and you recall the Quranic passage I read earlier, as all the other angels did, signifies that Satan alone manifests the purest devotion to God's oneness. He won't compromise his adherence to this monotheistic ideal, even if God himself commands him to. Satan thus becomes the paragon of Tawheed, the unwavering conviction that God is eternally and essentially one and alone to be worshipped. The belief in God's oneness is both the central theme and the central crux of Islamic theology. It seems quite simple. To state God is one would seem unproblematic. To proclaim there is no God but God and Muhammad is the emissary of God is the indispensable prerequisite for becoming a Muslim. But in fact, no tenet is so vexed in the long history of Islamic thought. Beyond such external threats to monotheism as Christianity with its doctrine of the Trinity and Manichaeism with its dualism, there lay the fatal fact embedded in our very natures that we are creatures given to idolatry. Sensual pleasures are obvious idols, but But there are also intellectual and spiritual idols as well. The ruler idolizes power. The scholar idolizes his books and learning itself. The warrior his skill at arms, and so forth. Our hearts and minds collude continually in this hidden idolatry. Pious practices, fasting and prayer, almsgiving, pilgrimage, assist us, but ultimately, only a kind of excision of the self will serve. This self-extirpation, which the Sufis call fana, is no mystical swoon. Rather, it entails a meticulous, dogged, gradual and unrelenting diminution of the individual identity, a willed erosion of the stubborn nugget of the self. Satan becomes, for certain mystics, the exemplar of single-minded devotion to and love of the one God. His devotion and love are all the more admirable in that they go unrewarded and indeed unacknowledged. In a sacred tradition, a man said to the prophet, "O emissary of God, I love you." Muhammad replied, "Prepare for destitution." The man then said, "I love God." The prophet replied, "Prepare for misery." Affliction, whether in the form of ostracism, poverty, disease, or social disgrace, can be a mark of God's attention. And Satan is the most afflicted of all. In another tradition, Jesus, who is considered a prophet in Islam, encounters three groups. The first group have wasted bodies and pallid faces. These are the believers who worship God out of fear of hell. The second group are even more emaciated. These have grown thin out of longing for paradise. The third group is utterly skeletal, but their faces glow like mirrors of light. These are the lovers of God who are beyond either fear of hell or hope of heaven. And Jesus exclaims to them three times over, "You are those brought near to God." To love God without fear or hope, that was the ultimate ideal. To love him purely for himself, to love him even if he damns you. Indeed, to love him especially if he damns you, because in hell, your praise and adoration of him will be selfless. And this it is that distinguishes the Sufi Satan. One of the early, more outrageous Sufis, as Shibli, meets Satan while on pilgrimage to Mecca. Astonished, he asks Satan, "What do you hope to achieve by performing the pilgrimage?" And Satan answers, and I quote, "I worshiped God for 100,000 years between fear and hope. I showed the angels the way to his presence. I opened the door for every person who had lost his way to God. My heart was filled with his sublimity. I professed his oneness. If he sent me away from his door for no reason, despite all these acts of obedience, then he can also accept me again without any reason. Since there is no how and why in God's acts, one should never abandon hope in him. His harshness rejected me, but his kindness may call me back." End quote. Satan is perhaps basing his hope on Quranic verses such as, "Do not despair of God's mercy. Only disbelievers despair of God's mercy." The same as Shibli was also heard to exclaim on his deathbed, "I am jealous of Satan, on whom God bestowed his curse." And to show how far this jealous passion for God might go, as Shibli also declared, "True love consists in your being too jealous regarding the beloved to let someone like yourself love him." For Ahmed al-Ghazali, the kid brother of the renowned Imam, Satan becomes a model figure. Satan is what he calls the black light. What does it mean to be such a light? Well, first, the black light stands in relation to the light of Muhammad, the Nur Muhammadiyya, not as its negation, but as its correlative. A light that radiates darkness. Could there be any greater contrast than with God himself, the light of the heavens and the earth, and light upon light, Nur ala Nur, as the famous verses have it? And Ahmed goes on to claim that, and I quote, "This black light is higher than the unpointed word." To say the formula is easy enough. To realize its import in one's very flesh is to be a true muwahid or monotheist. And for this reason, Satan, the black light, is a better believer than any ordinary believer who utters the sacred formula with his tongue, even if it comes from the depths of his heart. For Ahmed, Satan is a tragic lover of God. He defends him by saying, and I quote, "The poor guy didn't know that the claws of providence draw blood when they scratch, and that the arrows of predestination kill quickly when they fly." I've come to suspect that this unexpected transformation of Satan is connected with a renewal and full elaboration of the doctrine of the love of God among Muslim mystics. For this doctrine drew for its vocabulary and tropes on the conventional erotic poetry of Arabic and later Persian literature. The lover, the muhib, sighs, yearns, tosses and turns, utters rending sobs and heartbreaking groans. He is tormented by longing, burns for intimacy with a beloved, whose coquettish mockery and prevarications he must endure. Sometimes he even dies for love. The most authentic such love is that which is chaste, unrequited, and rejected. The purest lover is he who can hope for nothing, and yet who continues to burn in the fiery passion that consumes him. In this respect, Satan, who has loved God without hope for countless millennia, appears as the truest lover as well as the truest monotheist. A curious side effect of this exaltation of Satan is to alter the conception of evil in Islam. For if Satan, the very embodiment of evil, is the ultimate lover of God, evil can no longer have any force. And in fact, we find that Islam generally lacks a systematic doctrine of metaphysical evil. Evil evaporates before the divine omnipotence. Certain theologians, particularly of the Asharite school, had already ascribed the causation for evil to God himself, on the grounds that to do otherwise would be to lessen God's omnipotence. And this reversal of evil was to become mainstream doctrine. We may call things evil, but because they exist, they are expressions of God's will, and whatever God does is by definition good. These two themes, love and God's oneness, coalesce in the mystic's experience. To love God is to know him, and to know him is to recognize that everything in creation, from the scratching of a black ant on a dark stone at night to the motions of the celestial spheres, moves only through his will and command. Such love leads the mystic to recognize that what we habitually think of as agency or causality in the world is a fiction. Causality is God's custom, his usual way of doing things. But it's not intrinsically necessary or even finally demonstrable. Rather, everything at every instant of time is created afresh by God by the specifying action of his will, this is the technical term. And so everything, from the discrete quanta of time itself to all the possible objects of creation, from the physical world to the inner mental world, and even the stray thoughts in the mind, originate in the divine volition. To realize this perception is one thing. To realize it and to love God because of it, quite another. The millennial hopelessness of the devil in Islam, but also his darkly radiant grandeur, is to be such a knowing lover of the very God who has banished him. God, of course, may relent. He is free to do so. But Iblis does not love him out of hope of forgiveness. He is still the wily corrupter of souls, the whispering seducer, and yet, at the same time, he has assumed another dimension, mythic and exemplary at once, for those reckless or daring enough to follow him. Thank you.
Let me thank Professor Ormsby for a very interesting talk tonight. I've tried to pull together a few reflections on both the paper, and then I'm trying to move a little beyond that to think a little bit about the problem of the series that you all have been addressing this year, namely the problem of evil. And I'd like to say, with respect to Islam and the comments of Professor Ormsby, a few things in that regard. First of all, with respect to the lecture we've just heard, I think that our lecturer rightly shows that Satan is not really a principle, but only of evil, but rather a representative or an emblem of evil. I think the gist of his comments pushes quite correctly in that direction. Satan is depicted in Islamic tradition in a variety of parts of the tradition as a tempter or as someone who is deceitful, but not as some sort of originally evil principle in the cosmos. There's not the Manichaean or Zoroastrian, perhaps better, dualism of good and evil, and I'll come back to that in a moment. I think that the lecture also has rightly shown us that the satanic figure, or the figure of Satan, is an ambiguous figure, and I think the notion of two faces or three faces, in either case, there are different aspects to the figure of Satan, quite rightly. There, of course, I would note on this duality of the Satan figure and the ambiguity of the Satan figure, and the ambiguity that I would see as really divided between the figure of Iblis and Shaitan already in the Quran. Already in the Quran, if you take the Iblis passages and the Shaitan passages, I think it can pretty, and it has been by a couple of people, pretty clearly shown that the Iblis figure is much less decidedly evil, much less resolutely the tempter and the deceitful one who draws people away. He's a much more neutral figure than Shaitan. The Satan figure, who even in the Quran is already a much darker, more utterly negative figure. I think that he also rightly sees in the lecture the Sufi tradition as a hotbed of development of the what we might call the Iblisi tradition, if you like, the tradition of Iblis rather than the Shaitani traditions, which are the darker traditions, the more utterly negative side of the tradition. And I think he overall rightly shows that evil is not at the center in the Islamic Weltanschauung, the worldview of the Islamic of Islamic literature from the Quran forward to the present day, but rather is largely derivative somehow. It's a, or at least somehow off center in a way that in the Christian tradition, in particular, people are not used to, where the notion of evil is, I mean, just as it is in the Greek tradition, is much more a fixed ontological reality that human beings have to deal with. It's much more a tendency of human nature and of the natural order of things, which is generally imperfect because it's not divine, and therefore flawed, therefore easily susceptible to temptation, to falling prey to the nafs, or the lower self, the darker self, the id, all of which things we heard in the lecture. I would, however, like to raise two questions coming out of the lecture. The first of these is where I might take issue a bit with at least the suggestive idea that Professor Ormsby puts forward, that that where he when he says, and I should probably go back and quote that. He said his hypothesis, briefly put, is this: the doctrine of the love of God coincides with the transformation of Satan in the Islamic mystical tradition in a way that suggests that the two are linked. Now that I can basically go along with. The second part of the suggestion, if I'm understanding you correctly, though, is that you would see that as coming in the 12th century world forward in particular, following Ahmed al-Ghazali. And even Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, his brother, that following in their wake in particular in this sort of what I would call the mature phase and the of the development of Sufi tradition, that this is where this comes together and happens. It would be my own argument that I think one ought to take very seriously the degree of the development of love mysticism in particular in the early Sufi tradition, something Professor Ormsby knows very well and refers to. I simply wonder if it's not already there, if we're looking for love mysticism, that we would find all of the things one would have needed to have developed the Iblisi tradition in a full fashion. Let me just mention a few of the just examples of this earlier tradition of love mysticism, which I think really reaches its almost an early apogee, certainly in the 9th century, it seems to me. It begins, as he noted, with Rabi al-Adawiyya, who died right at the year 800 of the Common Era. 801 is her normally given date of death, as he noted, who was constantly and is constantly cited as worshiping God and wanting everyone to worship God only out of love, not out of hope of heaven or fear of hell. But there's also people like Ja'far as-Sadiq, the sixth imam of the Shiite tradition, who talks about degrees of knowledge of God and sees Moses as the model of divine love because he was the person closest to God who saw God face to face, talks about love as a divine fire that devours man utterly or wholly. Dhu'n-Nun al-Misri also has a number of things to say about love and the beloved. He says, "Publicly I call you Lord," speaking to God, "but in solitude I say, O my beloved." Love has also no end, he says, because the beloved has no end, the beloved being God, of course. That's reported by Attar. These later figures are reporting, at least, that these were the ideas of these earlier mystics. There were a lot of these love mystics. Nuri, Professor Ormsby mentioned, who certainly would be a salient example, died in 907. Sumnun is another one who died just after 900 sometime. We don't know exactly when. Both of Nuri and Sumnun were come out of the Baghdadi circle that much earlier, Rabi al-Adawiyya, although she was in Basra. They were both in Baghdad. But they come out of a Baghdadi circle where I think the love mysticism does start later and, of course, culminates with Al-Khalaj, whom he also mentioned in the lecture. And the notion of love and the suffering of love is strong for people like Nuri, for instance. Sumnun, who talks about love as superior to ma'rifah or gnosis in every way. And he has poetry, which is really quite wonderful, where he talks about when sleep takes me, I find the God between the eye and the eyelid. This notion that God is that close, which again is at least goes back to a particular passage in the Quran that said God is closer than the neck vein, than the carotid artery, if you like, to the human being. The second and final thing that I'd like to say a few words about and make at least raise a question that I'd like to make 4 points about. Is that of evil in the Islamic worldview, which talking about Iblis, I think, and the figure of Iblis as this paradoxical figure of the perfect monotheist because he refuses to obey God because God is telling him to bow down before something else other than God. This is a very interesting thing. And let me just make a couple of points on that. First of all, I think it's quite true, as his lecture amply indicated, that evil in Islamic view, as I've indicated earlier, is not a separate principle, nor, for that matter, is the devil itself, as he also noted, a self-sufficient force of evil alongside God in the world in some sort of dualistic sense. I think it's important to take the things that he noted at several points and emphasize them, that Satan is much more akin to human beings than to the divine. He is said to be either one of the jinn or one of the angels, both of whom are closer to human beings. The jinn in particular, jinn and men, if you like, are spoken of even in one of the passages he quoted from the Quran, min al-jinnati wa nas, for instance, from the jinn and the human beings. This is a recurring kind of duality in the Quran, and there are even passages in the Quran which talks about the jinn, some of the jinn hearing the Quran, or not in the Quran, but in later tradition, some of the, there's a mention in the Quran of jinn listening to the words of the Quran, but then later tradition interprets that as some converting at the sound of the Quran and some not, just as it was the case among human beings. But in all of these cases, even as an angel, certainly the devil, and therefore if you're going to conceive him as a principle of evil, is still subject to God. Humanity, a second point, is similarly not basically evil, as Professor Ormsby noted, only weak or faulty somehow. I like to use the term out of my distant Methodist background, where you talk about backsliding. You know, the human being, you know, he tries hard, but he's basically no damn good at some level. And that's the that's more the sort of offhand attitude that I find in most Muslim treatments of evil and good. That is, that the human being, you know, we struggle and try to do the right thing, or we hope people try to do the right thing, but it's very, very hard, given the fact that we are creatures of God and therefore not God and therefore flawed, contingent, passing beings who are on this earth briefly and who are not omniscient as God is. So part of the business of having an utterly omniscient God, part of the retroflex motion of that is that his creatures are not all the things that he is or she is. Evil, therefore, is not primary, as I've indicated, and I think the eloquent Nafs discussion, the discussion about the soul or the self, the lower self, as the Sufis sometimes put it, that Professor Ormsby gave us made that very clear. So therefore, evil is instead always under God, and I think that stresses a theme that runs throughout all of Islamic theological argumentation, philosophical thinking in some ways, and certainly is also there in the background of Sufi things and even of the legal tradition, and that is the notion that even justice can't be set up as an absolute principle because that would be making God lower than something else. And this was what the Mu'tazila tried to do, a famous group of thinkers, more rationalist-inclined thinkers, who logically felt, well, God has to be good and wanted to argue that it has to be good and wanted to argue that justice was an absolute principle in the world. And what the more conservative tradition that eventually won the day in Islam saw as wrong in that was that it made God have to be just, have to be good according to norms of justice and goodness that operated in the human world but not in God's world, except where God made them operate. So everything, in a way, is subject to the will and the command of God. And that means that that gives us, I think, a clear idea of where evil has to be in God's creation, namely as a part of that creation, something that God ultimately controls, even if he chooses to let evil run its course, to let Satan run around and tempt people, to let the waswas al-khannas, the whispering of the seducer, get to people. That's God's choice. It's not because it has to be that way or because some principle of evil has overwhelmed God or is in somehow even tension battle with God. Certainly, there's an opposition of the devil to God's will in the world, but in a way, the world could not exist as a place of choice and action and piety, even, if you didn't have the opposition of some sort of presence of evil, even if it's not a cosmic principle, as it might be, as I say, in a dualistic system. So obedience to God, in the Muslim view, is really the only antidote to evil. Individual responsibility is extremely important here. And for that matter, so is a social assignment of blame. I mean, often that's the way the term usually is used, that such and such an action is deserving of blame. It is blameworthy, is a way of designating from the collectivity of society what is evil. That's a social idea, if you like. But the individual responsibility of every human being is always to obey God, as the only real antidote to evil. That is, the if there's any redemption available, it's either in God's mercy that comes without, as was indicated in the lecture, without our doing anything for it or without our being able to force it to come, or it's in our ability to be obedient to God and therefore be rewarded according to God's promise. So those two things seem to me to be important parts of trying to wrestle with the problem of evil in an Islamic context. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture titled The Great Satan, Images of Evil in Islamic Tradition, the last in a series of lectures looking at the topic of evil presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Our main speaker tonight was Eric Ormsby, director of the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University. We also heard comments from William Graham, Professor of Divinity and Dean of the Harvard Divinity School. Tonight's moderator was Ray Hart, Professor of Religion and Dean ad interim of the School of Theology at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Associate Professor of Religion and Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.